Welcome, everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual and our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, JT, he's an amazing guy. He gets around, goes to a lot of different meetings. I see him here, and when he shares, he's always got that baseball cap on. Wore his coat and tie tonight. I have really been looking forward to this. And I'm going to let him tell you the rest of the story. Come on, Jay. How about a warm welcome?
Thank you. Thank you to everybody, because it's appropriate to say thank you for the applause. I like to remind people we are alcoholics and we are at Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And it's probably not the kind of thing that you want to be chipping out a badge of pride for. And that's kind of what happens sometimes when people are patting you on the back and applauding for you. I've been enough places to know that it's got to be so much deeper than that. I am Jay, and I'm an alcoholic. And my AA sobriety date is 8892. And so if you are aware of the calendar, you know it's kind of coming up. And I am walking very carefully this week. Shared with my dear friend the other night that I'm this week before my anniversary. It's been my practice to walk very carefully. I am not so confident, if you will, in anything in life as to say that I would be sober August 8th, 2014, except that I do certain things. And so one of the things Tim said, I show up at a lot of places, I go to a lot of meetings, and I have a lot of literature, and I read a lot of literature, and I'm excited about literature meetings. And so if you'll allow me, I'd like to kind of use as a springboard a couple of things that have helped me so much for a long time. And one of them is the little 24-hour day book. You can't see it, black book with little gold letters. That's because it's in this lovely cover that a sponsor gave me probably 15 years ago. It was 1999. You figure that out. And I keep it because at the time, the one I had been worn out. It was breaking apart and pages coming out. But the trick with this thing is I like books. I love books. I'm a bibliophile. And so I ramble in bookstores. And I was at that time living in New England and rambling in a bookstore and found a book called God Calling. Now, my background is in religion, but I've been religious, been in church my whole life, so I liked it. And so I grabbed the book. And it was a little diary of anonymous people writing about God back and forth and so forth and so on. Well, I grabbed that book. A few months later, I stumbled into the 24-hour day book and found out that it was based on that book. In this context, I was helping some guys come out of jail. I'll tell you more about that later. Get out of jail, and we were trying to help them hook up with their families and the communities, okay? And we found out for some reason they couldn't stay sober. And so somebody in a group meeting said, well, there's this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of people say it works. And so somebody else said, well, you know, why don't we get them to go there? And so it was decided that I would drive these guys to the AA meetings. Now, you know about how long it took to find out that the alcoholic, you know, who's not really ready to go to an AA meeting, he's going to go because I want him to go, he's not going to stay in the meeting. So about 2 days after I started dropping them off at a 7:30 in the morning meeting, I come to realize that they had, you know, run their little rendezvous and were back at the meeting when I came to pick them up at 8:30 because a couple of neighbors said, yeah. So then it was suggested, well, Jay, why don't you go with them to the meeting? Good idea, you know, okay. And I went. And so in the context of doing that, that's how I came to know about Alcoholics Anonymous. So now I find this little 24-hour day book, and it has a meditation in it about Alcoholics Anonymous. It has a straight-out God-based meditation, and it has a two-line prayer. And I love the two-line prayer because I've been praying all my life, but prayers are tricky because they can get too long. You don't want to say the wrong thing. You know, I heard years ago, be careful what you pray for, you know, and I had done that a couple of times. And yeah, I got it, and it was the wrong thing, you know, and it's hard to kind of pray to get out of that stuff. It's tricky, you know. So I was delighted to find a two-line prayer that said just enough about where I was, you know, and it usually talks about humility and help and that kind of thing. So let me just share August 4th, the meditation for the day. Well, let me get a couple of lines out of the first part. It says, we in AA are offering a kind of psychological program as well as a spiritual one. First, the man must be mentally, a man or woman, must be mentally able to receive it. He must have made up his mind that he wants to quit drinking, and he must be willing. Anybody ever heard that word? To do something about it. His confidence must be obtained. We must show him that we are his friends and really desire to help him. And when we have his confidence, he will listen to us. Then the AA fellowship is a kind of group therapy. A newcomer needs the fellowship of other alcoholics who understand his problem because they have had it themselves. The individual must learn to re-educate his mind. He must learn to think differently. And then they always have a question for the day. And I would take that question, I just kind of turn it around in my head, and I still do, you know, whatever the calendar date is. So the question today said, do I do my best to give mental help? Then the meditation for today, and this is life eternal, that they may know thee, and thee is in capital letters. It is the flow of the life eternal through spirit, mind, and body that cleanses, heals, restores, and renews. Seek conscious contact with God more and more each day. Make God an abiding presence during the day. Be conscious of His Spirit help, and it's helping you. All that is done without God's Spirit is passing. All that is done with God's Spirit is life eternal. The prayer for today says, I pray that I may be in the stream of eternal life. I pray that I may be cleansed and healed by the eternal Spirit. I hope you believe me when I tell you that I believe I made contact with the eternal Spirit. And it was what I was needing and looking for my whole life. And every drink I took and every drunk I had, I really thought I was getting closer to it, but I thought when I got it, I'd be really drunk. I'd be really intoxicated. And because of that, it's a little out of sync in terms of the calendar time. One of the last desires to really get messed up I had was when I came out of my third year of seminary in New York City, and I had planned to do this one last real serious blowout. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is NABA, but my old sponsor, who had 40 years that had initiated here in NABA, said to me before he died, it's really hard to find a pure alcoholic these days, and so I'm not a pure alcoholic. So my dream was to drink all the alcohol I could drink, but most importantly, get me some good acid. Window pane. And I knew so much about feeling good and getting high that I had to have, you know, the right window pane. I had to have the right club in New York City. downtown Judy Brown. She used to have a television show. I wanted to be at the club she was standing in front of, hoping Judy was going to be there, you know. And I was dry enough at the time to know I needed to have somebody to help me out. And so I had, believe it or not, I asked a friend. I have a dear friend who's a Baptist pastor. I asked him, I said, you know, kind of like, will you hang out with me? And the idea was that he was going to cover my back, you know, just in case things got a little too crazy. Because I also had in mind some good sex, you know. And I had seen so many folk in New York that were just hot as, you know. And it was just like, so it's got to be the right one of them, too. You know, so I'm busy putting all the rights in place. And I had that thing in my head. Anyway, it didn't happen. I'm grateful it didn't. And it was years later, and I'm in AA and coming to peel the layers off of my story to know that it had not happened, and I should be grateful it didn't happen. I'm convinced that I have a disease called Moreism, and basically that means I never have enough of anything. And never have. And it's a really funny thing because, well, I didn't want much of this life, actually. I was almost a stillborn baby. And they tell me, and we had a little family folklore going on in my family, that when my mother was pregnant with me, she had a lump in her stomach, but I didn't move. And so all of her friends and all thought she had a tumor. And in those days, quite a few years ago, people, at least black people in the South, really bought into palm readers and the old wives' tales and stuff. They talked about, you know, the baby being born with the veil over his face and all of that stuff. Well, she went to a palm reader, and the palm reader told her, said, no, you don't have a tumor, but you're pregnant. You're pregnant with a son, and he's going to be a preacher. Well, you know anything about African-American history and culture? You know the glories we have in the black church. I mean, okay, but that's what it's called traditionally, the black church. And so that was probably very good news to her, that she's going to have a son and he's going to be a preacher because he's going to be one who carries the gospel, carries the good news. Well, anyway, that was the family fable, and my elder sister was the one that would relay it to me. And it was always kind of there. So anytime I did anything kind of weird, you know, play by myself. He's going to be a preacher. Look at it, you know. Getting mad with somebody. He's going to be a preacher. Look at him, you know. And so that was what I kind of grew up with. Another book I like in AA is As Bill Sees It. And I felt it was a special blessing. I really felt it was a touch from God. I opened the page 209 tonight, and the title says, Never the Same Again. It says, it was discovered that when one alcoholic had planted in the mind of another the true nature of his malady, that person could never be the same again. Following every spree, he would say to himself, maybe those AAs were right. After a few such experiences, often before the onset of extreme difficulties, he would return to us convinced. Then it says, in the first years, those of us who sobered up in AA had been grim and utterly hopeless cases. But then we began to have success with milder alcoholics and even some potential alcoholics. Younger folks appeared. Lots of people turned up who still had jobs, homes, health, and even good social standing. Of course, it was necessary for these newcomers to hit bottom emotionally. But they did not have to hit every possible bottom in order to admit that they were licked. That comes from the 12 and 12 on page 23 and 24. And then another book called AA Comes of Age on page 199. I saw that thing about milder alcoholics, even some potential alcoholics. I think I'm the utterly hopeless case. Grim. One of the things I've done since I've been AA, I've never bought the idea that I came in here on a high bottom. Even though I had a job, I wasn't sleeping on the tent, God, listen, I lived on Cape Cod, and everywhere I went, people would say, oh, you're from God's country. It's the funniest thing to me is that I tell them now when I'm from Georgia, they say, damn, it's hot as hell down there, isn't it? This is the alcoholic. I made the decision to leave God's country. And that decision was made in the context of starting to drink after quite a period of being dry. I was born here in Georgia. I don't think people should ever be surprised when we say we have a mother and father, because it kind of takes the both of them to get us here. Here in Atlanta, actually, and I'm part of the first generation of my family. The Taylors is my last name. Oops, did I blow my anonymity? Well, born in the city of Atlanta, and family's from Taylor County and Talbot County, and I always like to think, I still like to think, that we might be related to whoever they named the counties after, but big deal it has done. I still have to go to work every day. But what happened was my mother was murdered by our next-door neighbor when I was 3 years old. Shot standing talking to friends on the corner in front of the house. And it was April Fool's Day. Now, I came to know that since I've been in recovery. I've done some research because I got curious, you know, because I grew up as a child. It was always me and my sister. I have a younger sister, so it was always, aren't they pitiful, aren't they sad, because, you know, we lost our mother. And, you know, left a working father with two children, one 3 and one just barely 2. And so we went from pillar to post for a while. And I say pillar to post, that's an old Southern saying they used to hear that people wanted to take care of the children. They didn't want the children to have to go from pillar to post, you know. In other words, you don't really have a home. And so that happened for a while. It seems that my grandmother on my mother's side and her sister, her twin sister, had made a deal that one of them would get the children for a while and the other one would keep the children for a while. And they would kind of deal through it that way. You know, that must have been horrific. I didn't give you my age. I ain't comfortable with it, but I better get comfortable with it. This was in 1955. And I say that because, oh, we're so richly blessed in America, because, you know, so many things that used to be doubly horrific are much easier now. You have a lot more supports in your government and your communities and stuff. You didn't have that stuff then. This street that my father lived on was Road Street over in Vine City. And I just found out the other day, it's around the corner from the Bluff. I've been hearing about the Bluff for years and have not known where it was. I know now. And I happen to know because, as the higher power would have it, this week, I think prepping me for doing this right now, my job required me to go over there with a bunch of public school teachers to get off the bus and walk the neighborhood. I don't know why we couldn't have stayed on the bus, you know. So, anyway, I get off the bus. And, you know, they stop the bus right in the middle of the Bluff. Anyway, so where the Bluff is, my father's house was right around the corner. The street runs right up into the corner. And the point I was going to make, in those days, where his house was, the pavement stopped. Cemented all the way down to where his house was, and from there on was dirt road. City, the government, all kinds of things. It wasn't just racism. It was classism. It was a lot of isms, you know. Okay. Ooh, crazy times. But anyway, anyway, I look at that kind of funny because that means we were on a line of demarcation. Now, right behind where his house was the Herndon Mansion. It was one of the wealthiest black families in this city. Right behind my father's house, you know. But we were struggling. I used to try to say when I was at school, we have to tell people what your daddy did. I try to call him a porter. And basically, he was a laborer. He worked out at the Georgia Farmers Market from the time he was 18. But that's the kind of man he was. He was working at the Farmers Market, a laborer loading and unloading trucks. He had 2 children. The man next door had shot his wife. You know, so it was a harsh reality there. Fortunately, like I said, my aunt, my grandmother and my aunt, spent time with us. A little time before that, we were booted around to a couple of cousins' house. I had a boy rub himself up on my booty. You know what I'm talking about. Playing with little kids in a way you shouldn't do that. I had another fella, you know, I was afraid of garbage men. And so when the garbage truck came, I always ran and hid in the house. And this one said, you know, you're going to face that because you're going to be a man, you know. And he grabs me and twists my arm and forces me out on the porch to watch the garbage man come, you know. And, of course, I wrestle myself away from him and ended up running around the house and ran right into the doggone garbage man. Well, I'm no longer afraid of garbage men. Might have been better off if I had been. So those were the kind of things that were happening to this little boy. In the context of his mother having died, I had an older brother, a brother at least 18 years older than me, who had always gone off to service. And story now tells that, you know, he had come back to try to get us and left again. So my dad and his two children. And I'm very fortunate to have had the father I had because he did love us and made tremendous sacrifices for us. Ultimately, he killed himself. 25 years later, and it happened about a week after I got my bachelor's degree from Howard University, and he had kind of taunted me one time. I got my high school class ring, you know, big old pretty, much bigger and prettier in high school, big old shining rock on it, and I brought it home. I said, look, Dad, you know, I finished high school, and he just kind of, you know, a little depressed stamp, looked at it, and said, okay, good. Now go get the real one. Handed it right back to me. And needless to say, that messed up this alcoholic's head to get the real one and have him kill himself a week after that. Now, interestingly enough, the week before he committed suicide, I had been at a party. Yeah, we were drinking. We had a good time. We were getting ready to do a little orgy thing. But I had a friend who loved me enough, okay, he loved me enough to get my, you know what, out of there. And so we're walking down the street, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, well, why was he so nice to me? You know, how is it that he take rescuing? Because I knew what almost happened. I'm glad it didn't happen. And we're in a park. We're in Meridian Hill Park in Washington, D.C., and I'm sitting there. I said, Tyrone was his name. Tyrone, Ty, man. I said, I think it's time I start changing, you know, chilling out. What do you mean? Well, and what I had in mind was that I was going to do fewer of those acid drop weekends, and I was going to probably just drink light wine. Not light. I was just going to drink wine. Because at the time, drinking wine did not seem like drinking. Okay? Drinking, and we thought at that time, drinking was those folk who drink straight liquor, you know? I mean, people who talk about vodka and gin and bourbon and stuff, those are alcoholics, you know. Those are drinkers, you know. We're just socializing, you know. That was what I had in my mind. Thank God for AA, because I can finally tell people what was in my mind. And you guys can't let the white coats come and get me, because they probably pick you up too. All of this stuff I was sitting on, cooking on for many years. So that happened about a week before this, you know, my dad killed himself. When he killed himself, next time I remember thinking about sobriety, I was in the disco, dancing really hard, you know, and got one of those zoop that you get sometimes when you mix all that stuff. And I said, oh, you said you were going to stop doing this. Well, I hadn't stopped doing it, and so I continued to do it. I was in college when this stuff was going on, and had never heard, basically, that there was a science to alcoholism and that there was a treatment to it. The other side of my family story is that every man in my family, everyone, drank too much. And that's what we said. They drank too much. And in the course of that, while I'm growing up, I had one dear cousin who only showed up at my house New Year's Day. And I liked him. He was a veteran, and he always came to get me to fill out his veteran's papers. And he'd take me downtown and promise me he's going to buy me a suit. You know, and I'm not spending time with him. And lo and behold, one New Year's Day, he didn't show up. And just about the time my aunt said he hadn't come, we got a phone call. And it was to come down to the hospital and identify his body. And we found out that he had, in a drunken stupor, been hit by a car, and died in the winter. His brother, the very next year, in about the same neighborhood, froze to death, sitting in a doorway, drunk. And I would tell people, in Atlanta, you know how hard you have to work at freezing to death in Atlanta? Well, anyway, he did it. That was his brother the next year. So I heard that story. And another cousin, my cousin for whom I'm named, actually, he would be Jay. If he said he was not far, he'd be Jay, too. But his story was he had quarrels with his wife, and she used to beat the blankin' blank out of him. So bad that one day, you know, he had his head bandaged up, and I love that movie, The Mummy, because my cousin James kind of looked like that. And that would happen on and off. And the thing was, they were drinking too much. Yeah. And another cousin, Moses. And I like Moses. Moses was the darkest relative in our family. And all these men are good looking. And I, okay, people. Some people heard me tell. I don't mind good looking men. And I had a bunch of them in my family. I mean sharp looking, you know. And Moses, we could never know where he was. He's wandering the street, you know, and somebody would say, well, we picked Moses up over here, we picked him up over there. And ultimately that happened to the extent that in 2000, we picked him up the last time under a bush. Drunk, of course, you know. One of the things that happened, these were cousins, but I didn't have any other males. My brother was away from us, and so they were my role models. These were the guys who were shaping me, telling me how to be a man. And those cousins were important to me. I liked to watch them. And two of them got together, two brothers, and went and picked up the other brother who was just coming out of the hospital for cirrhosis, the liver thing, you know. And the doctor told him, you know, if you drink again, you'll die. What do you think his two brothers took him to do? What do you think happened? Thank you. Okay. He was the most handsome. He was the youngest, and he was the smartest. He was a community activist. I had always looked up to him. If he ever disappointed me by doing anything, he did that, you know. Now, in all of that, my father was the only one. I looked up to him almost like God because I didn't see him drinking. When I was about six, he came Christmas Day. He was drunk enough to try to sit on my sister's little play piano bench, and it broke. And he never let us see him drunk like that again. I had the privilege, or whatever you would call it, to clean up the mess left when he shot himself in the head. And it was a powerful experience for me to clean up all that stuff. And I'm scarred by it. I tell you, I'm still working on that. Because I actually stood in my daddy's blood and slipped in it, you know, all I had, get rid of the mattress, you know. Because all my family, nobody, I ain't going over there. You know, I had one cousin was curious, wanted to go see what it looked like. And she wouldn't walk in the room because they said, you know, in those rooms where people die, especially when they kill themselves, it's spooky. So anyway, I had this. The point about all that is, when I got through cleaning out the house, what do you think I found in the basement? Big old jug full of homemade hooch, white grapes and stuff. And I remember pouring it in the Georgia clay, and it was in May. The worms came out of the ground, and I remember thinking, I said, "Boy, you know, that's some stuff." Now, that's some stuff, okay? So that's how it was. Jay is taking pictures of all this stuff. That's how it was. This is what's shaping Jay, okay? Now, Mr. Will lived down the street from me, and I lived in a segregated neighborhood. It was all black people. We were privileged because we got to move into the houses that had been vacated by the ministers and the doctors, the pastors and the doctors. So, and we lived in independent houses, okay? And I used to tell my little cousin, you can't pick on me because I live in a house. And you live in a rented property, you know. Yeah. Anyway, kids, you know, if you survive your childhood, you can make it. But Mr. Will, I like thinking about Mr. Will. He wore a black fedora and a starched white shirt every day and suspenders and some nice gabardine pants. And Mr. Will sold liquor. They never told us that, but we know he had the party house. And he walked around, you know, hands in pockets looking neat and stuff. So that was, these are the pictures I saw, okay. My mother, as I said, was murdered. That was my mother. But I have another lady. I ended up calling my mother, and she was my aunt. She was my my father's sister, who became guardian for my sister and me, and loved us so richly. They didn't have children, so I think we were what they needed. And she loved us so richly that I ended up calling her mother. She occasionally would have friends over, and they would drink out of these little pretty glasses with the gold things on it and all. And I remember walking in the room one night after friends were gone and smelling the whiskey. And it was so enticing, you know. So I was just kind of like drawn right in there like a bee, you know. And quick, before she realized, I'd sip a little something. Nice, you know. So, okay, got away with that. Never heard of alcoholism as a science, as a disease, all of that stuff, you know. This is just life, you know. I like to tell people I loved the commercials for soap operas, because I don't know if you all remember the 60s and the late 50s, but soap operas, ding dong, this is how they're going to have a commercial. See, the bell rings, and so somebody's at the door. They go to the door. Hey, Mary, good to see you. Can I get you a drink? And the best drink that you could have in those commercials was a martini. So I grew up thinking, this is how you live? Well, you got to get the right martini. Okay? Managed to survive all of that stuff. Go to college. Like I said, my dad killed himself. Okay? I came home, did what I thought I should have done, went back to continuing graduate school. I'm going to rush myself a little ahead here now. You heard it enough. You can imagine all the other stuff. So now I am in seminary. And summertime comes, and we can't afford to be there, so I need to work. Somebody comes and says, Jay, say, you've got a really good opportunity here. You're going to have a house on Cape Cod. Wow, for a summer job. Come to find out the person who had been chosen for the job had a tragedy, had to give it up, and there it was. Boom. So I spoke to an Episcopal priest who was directing the program, and so he told me, said, what you're going to be doing, you're going to live in the house, you're going to be guiding men, you're going to take them out of the jail, counsel them, yada, yada, yada. Okay, fine. I can do that. Hung the phone up. Well, he called right back. He said, oh, what I forgot to tell you is that most of the men are alcoholic. And you know what I said? I said, no big deal. You know, I said, every man in my family is an alcoholic. I hung the phone up. You know, no big deal. Now, in the meantime, yes, I am drinking. I have a history of acid behind me and stuff like that. But during this time, I'm just not doing it. Dry drunk syndrome. Okay? I was sober. I was not using. Okay? Not necessarily happy because I was not. I still had in mind I was going to get wealthy enough to retire into a big wing chair in my library and sip my bourbon. I don't know if anybody's read that story in the big book. But that was my idea of good life. That's what I planned. Got to do that and run a program called the Friends of Prisoners, and that's how I heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, as I shared with you earlier. Okay, in the course of all of this, my life is going like that. I'm somebody. I get called to advise the local community college director. The superintendent of schools calls me. I get to make public statements. They write it up in the newspaper and everything. I'm not drinking. I got invited finally to a little spaghetti dinner by one of the social workers that was working with our program, and a nice little house. And I loved the house because he had a wine cellar. It wasn't a big elaborate house, but he had a wine cellar. And I always wanted to have one of those. And so anyway, you know, what is it, the red wine you drink with spaghetti. So I had one, but I haven't had anything to drink in a long time. And, I should tell you, the relapse happened before that. I'm out. I got a lovely girlfriend. I'm engaged to marry her, and I'm in the restaurant. And I see the waiter walking through the room with a bag of rolls. And I said to her, I used to love white wine and bread. I did. I used to savor that. So she says to me, how long has it been since you had some? I said, well, I don't know. Why don't you get some? I got some. Nothing happened. I enjoyed it, you know. But now I'm at a spaghetti dinner and got red wine, you know, and I'm thinking, sort of, wow, this is nice. You're covering the red and the white, you know. Okay. Well, trick was, I drank the one, and so then we're walking through the house, and I'm, you know, that can't be right because I used to drink this stuff by the bottles. Anyway, got another glass. Okay, so I got I got to go. Get in my car, and I can hardly drive. Anybody who's been on the Cape knows that at night, those roads are really dark. They don't have street lights. So now I'm worried I'm going to be a Ted Kennedy example because I'm going to end up in the marsh. And I don't have the girlfriend or boyfriend in the car. They're going to say, this was really bad, you know. And so, boop, 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 managed to get home. Now, this house is a sober house that I'm running. I've got to sneak into the house that is my house that I'm running because I don't want the guys to know that I've been drinking, you know, or that I'm messed up. And so I managed to sneak in. I mean, I thought about doing the window, but I did manage to just get to the lock and get in. Okay, so I go in. On down we go, a few more months. Okay. Didn't end up marrying that young lady. She decided not to marry me for a number of reasons. So what did I do? I got engaged to her best girlfriend. We had all been friends. All right, so finally, I'm making it. I'm going to marry this young lady. We're going to move to Atlanta. And she has a friend who's going to do the moving. He's going to pick up all of my things. He's going to take them to Philadelphia, pick up all of her things. And then he's going to roll on down to Atlanta. That was the plan. Well, 40 minutes away from my house, he calls me to tell me that there was a fire. And all of my stuff is burning up on the side of the road. And he's on his way back to Philadelphia. This coincidentally was happening while she was having her bridal shower. So when I call and interrupt the bridal shower, and she says, you know, oh, it's too bad it happened, but that's my family, that's my friend. You can't be talking about suing him, you know. And I said, what is it, you know? I said, calm down, she said. Get yourself a drink of wine. What? I think I'm an alcoholic. I'm thinking at this point in time, murder. And I said, well, suicide and murder, you know. I actually went to a bottom there and I processed this whole thing about God. How could this happen to me? I'm doing good. Going to look at the stuff in the dump. One of the guys that I was helping said to me, Jay, we do bad things and we get in trouble, but we deserve it. We have watched you. You've been helping us. And this ain't supposed to happen to you. Well, the Bible talks about God, you know, and, you know, good and evil, and how God loves us all. It's a little verse. We don't pay much attention to it. And so I tried to share that with him. But I was feeling the same thing. Why is this happening to me? How could I have written a story where I had been invited, because people saw me helping these alcoholics go to AA meetings, I had been invited to come to a meeting Tuesday morning at 7:30. This happened on Saturday. I felt so bad, so betrayed by God, I really did plan to kill myself. Now, in the meantime, I had a bottle of Bacardi rum that had never been opened, that had been gifted to me in Cuba 10 years before that, that I had been moving around, hiding beneath my sink in my bathroom, virtually everywhere I went, because I didn't want people to know I had this bottle. And this made me feel bad enough to pull that bottle out. And I knew if I drank that bottle, I would kill myself. And then I was just mean enough to say, but killing yourself is not going to be enough. She's got to know you did it because of her, so I got to go and commit murder first and then come back. So you know how the alcoholic mind is. This is getting a little too elaborate. Then I remember somebody had invited me to an AA meeting, and I didn't want to disappoint them. So I came to my first AA meeting for me that night at about 6 o'clock. I said nothing to anybody. I sat behind a famous woman who was known for alcoholism, who had not sobered up. She was sitting there drunk at that moment. I left that meeting. I went to another meeting that Sunday. Sunday night, went to another one, and managed to somehow get to the Tuesday morning meeting, a 7:30 meeting, and I ended up sitting there in front of a beautiful crowd just like you all are. And I said, I'm Jay, and I think I'm an alcoholic. And the whole room said, yes, Jay, we know. Now, that's kind of been my story in terms of me being an alcoholic. I never had to say, I think I'm an alcoholic again after that. I'm Jay, I'm an alcoholic. I have no doubt about it. I don't hang out in Tower Liquor. I went over there to get some peanut butter crackers, and that's when I found out how much I love smelling liquor. I've never gone back there again. It's been 15 years. I've been talking with God and still amazed, because you should sit in that upper room at the Triangle Club and look out the window at the Tower Liquor sign. Say, God, what are you saying to me? You convinced me I'm an alcoholic. Now you're going to sit me in a window looking at Tower Liquor sign. So far, so good. Okay, I got a few more days before my anniversary. How it is now. I love children. And everything I do, as far as an investment is concerned, I'm investing in the hopes of the future for children. I'm fortunate that I get to work with some children who are so close to being like me that I can almost always find an example of little James, whose mother was killed, you know, whose father killed himself. Whose brother, I'll tell you about my brother. You know, my brother came back in my life after being gone for 16 years. He got to spend 2 hours with me. He left to go back to Washington, D.C. and was killed on his job. I've had a good stroll with death, which has kept me in constant conversation with this idea of God. And so I'm really grateful to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and find out that it's written the way it is, that they talk about God in the literature, that we have prayers. These are things that I had always hung my hope on, but I've never had so much hope as I have when I found out that I could live, and I've been living quite a while now, without drinking and without alcohol and drugs. And I hope. Went to a doctor on the Cape, filled out the form, told him about my family. I don't know much about their medical history. I cannot know because they died, yada, yada, yada. You know what he did? He looked at me and he said, Jay, you've had a hard life. I'm not denying that anymore. But it is not a reason for me to continue on that premeditated, suicidal ideation of trying to find again something that I could only have that one time. I don't even know when I had the best drink of my life. It lasted so short. And I've been in trouble with it ever since then. Depression. I don't suffer with it anymore. I live with it. It's okay. At least I got a name for it. And that was not the case for so many years. My alcoholism. I don't suffer with it. I live with it. I got a name for it. Put me in the room alone with a bottle of liquor, I will drink it. I told a guy one time, look at the bottle. You don't talk to the bottle won't start saying anything to you. I never say that anymore. Never. It does talk to the alcoholic. Okay? I never got that perfect martini. I was pissed about that for 5 years. And I'm going to still tell you the honest to God's truth, and I'm going to close with this. My friends, if I had known I was going to come in here and this thing was going to work for me and I was going to find hope and be okay in 2014, having been in here since August 8th of 1992, I would have drunk a lot more liquor. I am not wasted this time. I read everything that suggests AA. I go to every meeting I possibly can. That is the mental help I've gotten that I needed. It's led me then to take better care of myself. I keep my weight down. I try to drink a lot of juices and stuff. I exercise. See, I love life today. And I couldn't say that before now. I would love life if I had the right wife, the right job, the right car. Okay? And I would be loving AA if I thought I was going to get that stuff back. But I'm okay just where I am. Just where I am. I don't do it so I can get a job. I've known people 23 years relapse. Okay, and die. People got good, great certifications back, relapse, and die. And I have no reason to believe that couldn't be my story. And the sad part of it is I would have disappointed many of you because I would have robbed you of the opportunity to have the life I've had. My name is Jay. I'm an alcoholic.
Dang. Oh, amazing. Thank you.
train got to leave. I can't have you, baby. Might as well drink gasoline. That's the drink I can't put down. Loving you's the kiss of death for. Don't know how I get through this whole long week. Lord, I can't sleep at night. Don't know how I get through this week. Death for.